We down to the faithful four here? I think somebody will be in. Class doubled in size in about 1 minute there. Yeah. Well, lesson 11. We want to continue reviewing here. And don't hesitate to ask any questions as they come up. Some of this I'm going to start going a little faster, so if you need a slower look at it, be sure and speak up, because it's hard to know what areas. I can kind of assume that something is pretty straightforward, and it may not be, so I want to make sure that this really is a review. I don't want to just charge through this so fast that we didn't really get a review, neither do I want to spend all of our time on it and not get any further, so we want to get a good balance.
Mike?
Yeah?
What is the proficiency that you find that you have in terms of being able to parse or recognize fully what is going on, or is it a lot of contextual that you're doing?
Well, as far as parsing and reading and translating and so forth, I find this. I find that as far as identifying forms and parsing and so forth, it comes pretty quick. Because it's not a matter of, looking at all the paradigms and so forth. You're using several keys. You're using the endings, even though there may be some funny things with the stem. You're picking up on the endings. You're picking up on the context. And so forth too, a little bit, but most of it really is endings. After a while, I find, I see the endings and it's just automatically transmitted. I don't even stop to think about where it is in there. But the things that the proficiency is probably lower on are just raw vocabulary, as far as if you see a word you haven't seen before or something, then you have to take time to look it up. Sometimes you can pick them up from context. So if you know the passage you're dealing with, if you know what it says, then you can get it from context too. But those are the areas where, you get slowed down the most.
What about, of course you're teaching it, but...
Yeah, that makes a difference.
Recognizing the endings and everything,
yeah.
But would you feel capable to sit down and write out paradigms?
Oh, to sit down and write paradigms on the spot? It's hard to say.
Or is it just one of those things where that's right.
Yeah, I kind of think of it that way, but I'm sure I wouldn't have any problem writing down the perfect and the imperfect paradigm for the verb without all the complications. And then, some of the simple complications, it should be a matter of making an adjustment and doing that. But when you get into hollow verbs and all the other stuff, no, I don't think, I wouldn't even want to try to write them all down. In other words, I memorized them at one time just like you guys have to. But, just for the purpose of getting that familiarity and getting through it once.
Right.
But it's not something you use often enough to really justify keeping hammering at it, In other words, it's just not worth it. So you just don't do it. And, of course, the person who spoke Hebrew, he probably wouldn't even be able to write down the paradigms we could write down, just because they don't even think of it. They're not thinking in terms of paradigms, just like we'd have a hard time writing down an English paradigm. So I think that's the kind of thing. But and as far as syntax is concerned, syntax of Hebrew is so simple, compared to other languages, that's seldom a problem. In other words, once you've been seen things like while consecutives and so forth, clause structures and construct relationships, then, once you see them, that's the stuff you're seeing all the time. I mean, and it's no problem. So I think vocabulary is the big thing, because the Old Testament is so vast, and there are lots of different words and different historical settings. Certain words are going to be predominant and so forth. It takes a little adjustment to get used to that. And then when you get to poetic books, you get a lot of streamlining of words, and things are a little, they're poetry, so they're a little bit stickier there sometimes too.
Tactical changes in there the way we do in poetry?
Yes, right. That's the kind of thing. Yeah, things gone that you expect to be there, and having to rely a little bit more on context sometimes, and the actual forms aren't any problem.
Right.
And the endings, those are still pretty easy to identify. And I suppose maybe one other area that sometimes slows you down is when you've got suffixes on top of suffixes. We haven't really got to them yet, but when you start having object suffixes as well as subject suffixes on verbs, then you get enough vowel point changes and things, and things gets encumbered enough that you can usually see the basic ending, and you can make a pretty good guess. But there's sometimes that you don't feel confident unless you look it up and check it out. So those are the kind of things, you know, you kind of have to decide what's a realistic approach to this. You know, you could either spend your lifetime just trying to memorize paradigms, and if you don't use it, you know, you've wasted time. And you kind of have to strike a balance. How much am I using this, and so forth, and remember the things that are really important so that you're not having to relearn your grammar every time you try to do a basic study. But don't spend a lot of time trying to memorize a lot of detailed vocabulary, things that you're not going to use. That you can look up pretty easily. So you want to have a kind of an efficient system for attacking it. And you won't really get to the point where you can just take the text and go through it without ever looking at any of the reference books. You could perhaps do that, but it would take you a good portion of your lifetime. A bigger portion is probably worthwhile for efficiency. But what we want to have is have no nagging questions about the grammatical meanings of things. We may have a little problem identifying what this is or that is because of the exceptions and hollow verbs and things like that. But once we've identified it, then we know what it does. We don't have any questions about how this word fits with that word in the sentence and so forth. We want to try to eliminate those. Really understand the grammar. So that's why we place certain emphases on that kind of thing. And we do look at the paradigms, but we don't have constant cumulative tests where you have to have all the paradigms available. And these last chapters where we go through, each chapter is going to have some other odd peculiarity. It really is. It would be a foolish waste of time, really, to try to keep all of that data logged in your mind all the time, because you're going to run into the forms infrequently enough, and when you run into the form, you'll probably be able to identify it anyway, and if not, you can check it, you know, real quickly. And, you know, you really haven't gained anything as far as your understanding of Hebrew is concerned. Then, of course, if you went to speak the language, then you'd probably shift to a completely different mode of trying to learn. You would get more involved in just spoken Hebrew, speaking it back and forth, language lab types of things, conversational types of things, and that would eliminate a lot of this other grammatical stuff anyway. We're learning grammar to a far greater depth than anybody who would just learn to speak Hebrew would. They're just kind of learning more habit patterns and some vocabulary and so forth. A little bit of grammar, but not the detail we're going into. So that's the kind of, you know, balance that you have to strike and say, what am I trying to do with Hebrew? And let's spend our time and hone the skills that are going to be important for me in doing exegesis of scriptures and translating scripture and being accurate giving an accurate representation of it. So you've only got a finite amount of time. It's best to use it that way.
So grammatical relationships and vocabulary are the key things. And if you get that, then you'll be able to pick up the context and what's going on.
Sure.
You can look up any fine details.
Right. Right, but you have to understand the grammar. So you have to understand what you have to know how to identify what a verb is. You have to know the difference between perfect and imperfect tenses. You have to know about the while consecutive clauses. You have to know, you know, these basically the construct relationship. You've got to know about if you're going to really be stuck, you know, and the functions of the various prepositions, the concept of the, you know, the wa and the ba and ka, these inseparable prepositions, and being able to look at a word you see and tell that a lama preposition is on it. Otherwise, if you didn't know that, you try to look up that whole word, you know, and of course the analytical is set up so you can find it under that and it'll break it down for you, but it'd save you a lot of time just to be able to see the root and just look it up right immediately. That's one thing you're going to find is even if you don't know what the word is, if it's a strong verb and you can tell because it's got three good consonants in it, you may not know what the verb means, but you'll be able to look at the form and tell exactly what the root is. And, you know, lop off the prefixes, lop off the suffixes, see the root and look at it directly and save yourself a lot of steps, too. So those are the kinds of things that are, but you have to understand the grammar. You know, that's what we're trying to do, is that's what we're spending all of our labor to do. And we have to deal with enough of the forms to be able to make that work. But we don't want to belabor the details of the forms to the exclusion of understanding grammar. I mean, it's conceivable to have a person who's got a super memory and he can memorize paradigms, but he still doesn't understand the Hebrew. He doesn't understand what he's got when he puts it together and how. So I like to lay the emphasis on the things that are going to be the most important for actually understanding Hebrew, and then be a little bit less stringent on some of the detail that's going to probably fade from the memory pretty quickly anyway, and is things that you can catch later on. But some things you can't catch later on. If you get misconcepts about the structure of the grammar, it could take you a long time to get that sorted out, and you could have confusions that would plague you for a long time. So, whereas if you couldn't remember what the form was for a hollow verb in the third person singular or something like that, that's pretty easy to look up, and you can find that information on your own out there. So what I want to see, I'm thinking of what's going to happen when you guys are out there halfway across the country pastoring a church or something, or teaching a study, or teaching in a Bible college in Europe or something like that. what I want you to be able to do is be able to piece things together and find, you know, if you've forgotten something, be able to look it up again and have it and incorporate it and not have any fundamental misunderstandings or questions of a, such a nature that you have to kind of go through it all over again. That's what we don't want to do. Okay.
And just to, for the future,
uh-huh.
But are you able to recognize readily pile and
oh, yes.
So on?
Oh, yeah.
We haven't gotten into that, so I don't know how.
Yeah, let's say almost always. There, the only problems come when you have irregular verbs, and sometimes a PO form. See, when you get a hollow, or when you get a guttural in something, and you can't, and the PL has the dogation, the second radical, and so forth, some things that you can identify them with. And if you don't, if the verb is irregular enough, sometimes you do get some confusion as to whether it's a PL form or a call form or something. It happens once in a while, but by and large, you can pick them up right away. Hith piles. Real easy to identify because you've got that hith prefix that's in, just stands out like a sore thumb. And hifil also, you've got a very, very strong and identifiable. Those, in fact, that's why one of the reasons they're kind of put at the end of the book, they're pretty easy to deal with. And the ending systems are the same as you've already learned, so it's just a matter of learning some changes within the word, and those are pretty good because you've got, you know, usually unchangeable long vowels involved and closed syllables stuck on in hithpael, and so they're kind of nice. They're nicer than a lot of other things. So, but I can't say that always. There are times, you know, I've done some studies sometimes where I first looked at it and I thought it was this, but as it turned out, it was something else. It happens once in a while, but not too often. You can usually pick them out real quick. Of course, it seems like the ones that are the most critical ones, are the ones where there's oddball verb forms or something, because that's the ones that there's been controversy about. And sometimes the form might be one or the other, and there's debate about it. You get into those questions, but yeah. But by and large, you're gonna identify those. They're not real frequent. Hithpael, for example, not real frequent, but you see them enough to. And they're so easy to recognize. That's not too much of a problem. Okay? So it's really, you know, and you'll get the feel for that after we start doing translating. You know, I think you'll kind of see what I mean. You can ramble along pretty good in looking at it. Once you start getting familiar with some basics, and there's going to be little things here and there. You know, you'll find a form that's a defective form or something, and you didn't recognize it right off the bat. Those little things will happen, but your basic understanding is going to have a good contiguous flow, and that's what we're really after. Okay, so lesson 11, we looked at these three olive verbs, peculiarity being, of course, the olive in the third position and the resulting quiescence of the olive and the lengthening of the pathak to a comet. Also, we see the tau getting the softer form, the dagesh being removed on the suffixes with tau, but other than that, it's basic same patterns that we've seen before. Matzah, matzah, etc. Matzah, etc. So if you remember those features, you pretty much have that one as well. And see, it's real easy to recognize these because the endings are the same as everything you've seen before. There's a little bit difference in the vowel points, but that's not a problem to identify. Some noun plurals here, majority feminine nouns in ah show no change in the stem before the plural ending. So most of your nouns with that ending kamate, feminine nouns, are going to have little no change. So shana becomes shanim, torah becomes toroth, etc. I don't think there's any need to belabor that one. But there is a note here at the bottom of the section, top of the page 48. Nouns of the general pattern, consonant, vowel, consonant, consonant, kamate, like malka. In other words, basically you're starting out with a short closed syllable with a consonant, vowel, consonant, and then another consonant. That's indicating a closing of the first syllable and the beginning of the second, you see. So your consonant splits between those two C's, those two consonants. That particular pattern, where two contiguous consonants are different, now, so this doesn't apply if the two consonants are the same, because then you just have a doubling and so forth, like ama, and it falls in the other pattern. But if you have two different consonants, separated by no vowel, in other words, one consonant closing the first syllable and the other one beginning the next, then there's a certain pattern for the plurals that those follow, basically. So malka, for example, becomes milachoth, and you get shawa comets pattern, shawa comets, and all of these three patterns. And it's kind of like, it almost reminds you of the segalit nouns getting that same kind of a pattern, shawa comets pattern in the plural. And it's probably best to think of this as just a, is just a certain pattern for the plural and not think of trying to shorten or lengthen things, because normally you can't shorten malka. You see, mal, the first syllable, has got a short vowel and a closed syllable, and those are normally impervious to shortening. And so it's probably best not to think of this as actually shortening, but rather just that it's just the whole thing has got a separate fixed pattern, and we just learn that pattern. So give a becomes give oath, etc. Give a oath, excuse me. And herpa becomes charaf oath. Then he's got a little note here about mitzvah becoming mitzvoth. And the mame is a prefix, not part of the root, is what they're claiming here. So in that case, you don't see the shortening. And it's probably because they're considering this thing as coming from a participle. And there are certain types of participles, once we get to passive participles and other dry verb participles, where you see a mame as a prefix on participle. So he hasn't really developed that for you yet, but that's the reason in this case there's an exception. All right, then you can just consider it an exception, I suppose, for this, for our purposes now. Interrogative ha. Remember the prefixed he with the chatef patak, in most cases, is prefixed to the first word of a sentence to turn it into a question. So this in effect functions like a question mark or an intonation pattern in English, where you can turn a statement into a question. So hashalach ha'ish, did the man send? So if you just said shalach ha'ish, the man sent, it would be a simple statement. You just put a ha in the front, ha shalach ha'ish, and then you've got, now, did the man send? And ha tova ha'aretz, is the land good? So you could just say tova ha'aretz, the land is good, but if you put the ha in the front, you can make a question out of the same thing. Before gutturals, the form is normally ha with no reduction, just with a full pathak. And so if it's before a guttural, you can consider it lengthened, I suppose. There isn't any doubling normally anyway, but this is the form that's normally before gutturals. Before a non-guttural consonant followed by schwa, the form is also ha. So if it's followed by schwa, excuse me, I skipped one. There's if the guttural is followed by a kamatz or a kamatz chatuf, either one, just that symbol, the form used is heh. So if it's either a kamatz or a kamatz chatuf following, then you use heh. And if it's followed by a schwa with a non-guttural consonant, then it's going to be ha with a full pathak. Then rarely one encounters the same doubling of the following consonant we met in the definite article. And that may raise some questions as to what's really happening. You know, there'll probably be some debates as to whether that's just really the article anyway, because it really looked exactly like the article, or whether it is the interrogative. So apparently they feel there's enough justification in context to say that it's got to be an interrogative even though it's got a doubling. So we'll have to kind of leave that somewhat debatable, perhaps. Okay. So that's really pretty simple. I mean, it's just a matter of the variation in the form of the thing. But the idea is just to turn something into a question. That's not the only way in Hebrew to make questions. Of course, we've already seen aye, words like that, where there are certain question words, just like Greek and English have. But you can also do this to change a statement into a question. And it effectively is corresponding to either an intonation or word order change in English. In English, we can take a statement and make a question out of it, usually with intonation pattern or word order. So we can say, the man sent, and then we could say, the man sent, and just change our intonation pattern with the exact same words and make a question. Or we could say, did the man send, and use an auxiliary verb and change the word order a little bit, and we can do the same thing. So Hebrew is doing it with this interrogative ha. I guess the only thing I should say, just as a warning, watch out for interrogative ha. Because if you're reading fast and so forth, you may miss it and just consider it an article or something. If a sentence doesn't seem to make any sense to you, or something's wrong, something's fishy, you might consider the existence. Look at that first letter in the sentence and see if it's a hey, and see what possibilities may exist there. Then a little bit more on the word asher. We saw above in section 32 that asher indicates that a following phrase modifies as a unit the preceding word. So it's used to make prepositional phrases, for example, attributed to nouns, make the whole phrase modify a noun. This is also true for clauses, as the following examples show. So not only prepositional phrases, but whole clauses, excuse me, can be attributive to a particular noun by the use of asher. So example here, HaKohen Asher Kathav Et HaDavar, the priest who wrote the word. Okay, now this is not a complete sentence, of course, because we're not told what this priest did beyond, you know, what it's all about. We're just told this is the priest who wrote the word. The priest who wrote the word. And the entire phrase, wrote the word, is attributed to priest. It's telling you something about the priest, and it's giving a quality or characteristic of the priest in terms of a whole clause. And the priest who wrote the word, that's the priest that we're talking about. And wrote the word, of course, is a... wrote is a verb, and word is a direct object. So it's a regular sentence structure. We're taking a whole clause and using that whole clause to modify the noun, and it's done with asher. Again, another example, hamal'ak asher shalach hamelech, the messenger whom the king sent. So the messenger, which messenger? The messenger which the king sent. Okay? So we'll run into some things like this again later on when we deal with some more prepositions and so forth, but that's... another good little note on asher. So asher is used to make things attributive to a noun. You can take a preposition phrase and do that. You can take an entire clause and do that. Okay, lesson 12, the verbs three hey in the perfect. Three hey were even more unusual than anything else we'd seen up to this time, just because the hey drops off and you get a hirik yod in many of the forms there as a different root. So you've got bana, Banasa, Banisa, Banis, Banisi, Banu, Banisem, Benisen, and Banitu, Baninu, excuse me, Baninu. And what you see there is you can consider almost two different stems involved, one just involving the BN sound, another involving the hirik yod attached to it. So note that the stem vowel in the first syllable behaves quite normally. First syllable's fine. The stem itself is variable, bana, banef, bani, beni, etc. And we must again point out that the he of the third masculine singular is not a real root consonant, but a mater lectionis for the final vowel. It is convenient, however, to follow traditional grammar and speak of this class of verbs as three he. Okay, then you can have more complications if you have a three he that's also one guttural, for example. You can start having more, you know, you have to apply the rules for several sets. And here it's not too bad because the one guttural has only one problem. That's the schwa, the first syllable under these forms that have the heavy suffix. And here's an example from Allah. It's Alithem, Alithen. So there's a three hey. The root, the dictionary form would be Allah. It's a three hey. It's also one guttural. So you have to use a chatet pathak instead of a schwa in that first syllable on those forms. Then the verb haya, to be, is inflected regularly as a member of this class. So it is a three hey and also a one guttural. And but there's also a peculiarity in addition to all of that. Instead of having a chatef pathak in those second person forms, plural forms, it's got a chatef segol. So that's something that just has to be remembered. It's got chatef segol in those two positions where it's shortened. So with that information, you can write the whole paradigm for haya now without any problem. It's just exactly like bana up here, except that in the third, in the second person plural forms, you're going to have a chatef segol in the first syllable. All right, directive ah. Now we have another kind of ah ended onto added onto the end of a word. The suffix kamatse is added to a noun. Indicates motion toward. So one might consider it almost a kind of an accusative. Like type of ending. It's not really accusative, but it's got the idea of motion, direction. It occurs on both proper nouns and common nouns, the latter with or without the article. So you sometimes may see the article on the noun, sometimes not. Kind of just depends on how that word is normally used. This ending is never stressed and may thus be distinguished from the feminine ending ah. So the feminine ending of a feminine noun is always going to carry the stress. But this directive ah does not carry the stress. Because directive ah cannot be added to all nouns, each form is best learned individually. So it's not a matter of just taking any noun and putting the directive on it. You can't do that. There's just a certain class of nouns that do this, and they're learned individually pretty much. And so he's just giving you a list of the most important ones using that suffix. And there are certain sometimes changes in the stem and so forth in the vowel points, and it's not worth a lengthy analysis and so forth, so it's best just to learn them as they are. So you've got Eretz becomes Arza, Bayith becomes Habaitha, etc. So you've got a number of examples here. You also see down here a note, especially its use on the directional adverbs, Ana meaning whither, Shama meaning hither or to what place, and Hena meaning hither to this place. So you see, if the question is having to do with motion, you're asking to what place are you going, or to to this place or to that place, having more of a demonstrative effect. You're seeing the idea of motion to this or that place, you see, and that's the idea that this directional kamate is showing. Also, in terms for directions, that seems rather logical. We've got safon, meaning north, and we've got safona, northward. So if you want to describe them actually in motion, northward, you would use that kamate ending, and the same for the other directions here. Okay. Little note on the vocabulary here for Elohim as a plural of majesty, and Yahweh, the name of God, and the fact that they pronounce it Adonai and so forth. This is most basic information that you have learned in the unfolding Rev classes. One thing, though, here is both of these words behave erratically after the prefix prepositions. The initial Aleph is lost in pronunciation. So for Elohim, it becomes Belohim, Lelohim, Kelohim, and for Adonai, the way they have set it up, if you're going to pronounce it Adonai, even if you use the tetragrammaton, it'd be Badonai, Ladonai, Kadonai, with the prefix prepositions. But since we're pronouncing it, we don't see any reason not to pronounce Yahweh, then you'll go ahead, even when you see that, and say, L'Yahweh, L'Yahweh, K'Yahweh. In other words, it's as effectively it has only a Shawa, as far as we're concerned. So those who wish to read Yahweh as Yahweh, the most likely original pronunciation, must remember to repoint these prepositions as B, Yahweh, L, Yahweh, etc. All right. Any questions there on this chapter? Much of this is just technical information. There's not too much grammar here. Okay, lesson 13, sentences with a nominal predicate. Okay, we've already seen predicate kind of constructions where you had an adjective and a noun juxtaposed together and no article on the adjective. That indicated a predicate position, and we said something like the king is good or something. Now we can have a similar kind of construction where you have two nouns juxtaposed, and that would indicate a predication. So we have Dawid Melek Tov, David is a good king. No verb form there, no form of the verb haya or something, just David is a good king, Dawid Melek Tov. So they're supplying this kind of what we English use as a verb to be for just by the grammatical construction. The demonstrative pronouns who and he and their plurals are often used in sentences of this type in the following way. You can have a sentence like Dawid hu melech tov or Dawid melech tov hu. And the word who, of course, that being either the demonstrative, or you can even consider it the word for he or she or something. That one, you know, or he or she. It kind of depends. Those words do double duty. But it's kind of hard to make a distinction here. He gives a kind of a guideline here just on the basis of the way it seems to have been done in the text. Although it's probable that the use of the demonstrative pronoun places a greater emphasis on one or the other of the sentence elements, it is impossible for us to determine this nuance with any accuracy since there are no informants available who speak biblical Hebrew. It is likely that sentence two above answers the question, who is a good king? Dawid who, Melech Tov, you see. In other words, you're asking the question, who's a good king? David, he's a good king. Or the second one, the second example, number three above, answers the question, what is David? David, a good king he is. You know, if you can almost think of it that way, and it maybe helps you see emphasis and where the who is put made to be dependent on what kind of question was asked and what kind of an answer, what kind of response you're giving forth. And then number one is just a neutral statement. It's a fact without a question in mind. It's just a statement of fact, indicative statement, David is a good king. And that's what you're going to see most frequently. But just keep this in mind. When you see who and he stuck into sentences and you're not sure exactly what they're for, they're sometimes hard to translate, but they will be used to give a little bit more emphasis to the kind of answer that's given to a question and so forth. instructions. All right, the verb haya, a little bit more about it. In preceding lessons, we've studied four types of nonverbal sentences. With adjectival predicate, like tov, ha'ish, just using the adjective as the predicate. With adverbial predicate, ha'ish, babayit, where you have a prepositional phrase now that's functioning as the predicate, the man is in the house. Or with existential predicate, yesh, ish, there is a man, using that existential type of format. Or with nominal predicate, which was just introduced above in this chapter, Dawid Melech Tov, David is a good king. So in all of those sentence types, none of them had a verb form. All of them are predicate type constructions one way or another, or they're understanding that what we would consider a verb form, at least in English. But none of these has any specific tense value. Since you have no verb form, you haven't got any way of really assigning a tense value. And that must rather depend on the context in which the sentence occurs. All of these sentences, however, may be converted into verbal sentences by using the verb haya. So they do have the ability to use haya to get more precision, especially when you want to designate it in a certain tense value, which in the perfect has the normal tense values of that form. So if you want to say the man is good, you can just say ha'ish tov. But if you want to say the man was good, then you'll need to give some kind of a word that'll give the information as far as past tense is concerned or completed action. And so you'll need a form of the verb haya. Haya ha'ish tov. Or the second example here, haya ha'ish babayit, the man was in the house. Or haya kesef, there was silver. Rather than saying there is, you know, you could say yesh kesef, there is silver, but this way you say haya kesef, there was silver. Or Dawid haya melech tov, David was a good king, if you wanted to specify that. Of course, you could use the imperfect if you want to do all these things in the future also, will be. And of course, they haven't looked at imperfects yet, so that's why they haven't really discussed that. Each one of these is negated with lo, just like any other perfect verb form. And note that yesh is replaced by haya in three, and that a negative existential sentence like ein kesef becomes lo haya kesef. So if you want to negate the verb haya, you do it with lo. You don't have a separate word like with yesh and ein to deal with. You just use lo haya kesef. Okay, now there's another interesting feature to haya that we should take note of here. And that is that in sentences of the type haya Dawid lamelech tov, the preposition lamah now on melech adds the nuance of becoming to the verb of being. Although such a sentence equates two nominal elements, it is nevertheless of type two. So there's an interesting development here, and it makes sense when you just, you know, stay within the Hebrew frame of mind. The difference between haya and its meaning to be and its meaning to become is largely set by the context, and one of the chief features to do that is this preposition lamed. You see, when you put lamed in it, literally it would be, and David was to a king, or to a good king. And you get an idea of, at first it may seem a little strange, but if you keep the idea of a progression and coming to a certain point, then you can see the idea of becoming. If David was, in other words, the picture is kind of, he was approaching, he was in the state of approaching to being a good king. And so the idea of become there. Becoming is the idea of coming into being, not being at the outset, but changing and transforming into being in that position. And I think it's a very logical way to express the idea of becoming. As a little side note on this, I think some of you are familiar with what's known as the gap theory, the idea that all of the millions of years of geologic history go between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. And what part of their argument is to say that in Genesis 1:2, when it says the earth was without form and void, they say that the verb haya is used there, and they say that the verb haya there can mean become as well as to be. Well, it is true, as you see here, that the verb haya may be translated become, but it's not the verb haya alone, it's the verb haya plus contextual considerations like this use of the preposition lamed. And they don't have any such contextual considerations there at all in that particular passage, so they're reading into it what they want it to be. And there's no justification in Hebrew for that. You need to have, I mean, this idea of Hebrew relying on the context is an important one, but that doesn't mean that anything goes. It doesn't mean that you can decide whatever it means, whatever you want, just because you interpret the context that way or whatever. You've got to be real careful with what the context does say and what it doesn't say. Because there are definite keys in context, and it's not a matter of just a random choice of what you want it to mean. Okay, here's another example here. This gets a little bit more complicated. Hayatha sarah La Abraham, La Isha. Here you've got two preposition lama constructions, and its translation may be Sarah became Abraham's wife. Literally, Sarah was to Abraham to a wife. And the idea here for the first, she obviously is not becoming Abraham. So, she's becoming a wife. So that's the thing you would say, that lama is the thing that's showing becoming, and the first lama is showing with reference to a more of a dative idea. So Abraham, Sarah became Abraham's wife, or Sarah became a wife of Abraham's, or Sarah was Abraham's wife. Then if we have, we replace lama with k, the idea of like or as, that changes the meaning to something like was acting in the capacity of, but not actually being. There you would have a sentence like, Sarah was to Abraham as a wife, which doesn't sound too good. So that would be in the act or capacity, but not actually being. So they've got some very, Hebrew, I think, is remarkable in how much meaning they get out of these three little prepositions. Depending on what they put it with and what kind of sentence structures they're involved in and the kind of idioms that are involved, they get some tremendous mileage out of these three little words. So here's some good examples of that. Okay. Then this idiom of possession can also be extended. This last point here, this idiom of possession can be extended with the use of hayah for pastime. We've already seen yeshla, or ainla, there is to someone or there is not to someone, the idea of possession. That can also be extended in the past using hayah. And so you have hayat son la Abraham, Abraham possessed cattle. Literally, there were cattle to Abraham. So the same thing happens there. Okay, noun plurals, a little bit more on that. Just kind of a catch-all here. Feminine nouns ending in eth, ath, at, ath, eth, oath, uth show much variety in the plural. Words given below are sufficient sampling in this group, whose forms must be learned singly as they occur. So there's nothing really to say about this except you've got to learn each one of them individually. Now, those are typical feminine endings. So your plurals in most cases here are oath plurals. There's an im there down there with chanith, but the rest of them are all oaths. No, I guess the second one there, eighth for time, is itim. But they're all feminine nouns, even though the im plurals occur in a couple of cases here. Okay, so you're just going to learn those individually. Any questions on this chapter? All right. Lesson 14, perfect of kam and ba. These are two verbs with only two letters, so you can see that there's going to be some potential problems here as far as the pattern from previous verbs are concerned. But really, they don't turn out to be quite as bad as it might appear. It's almost as though you've lopped off the first syllable and you put the rest of it on. You start out with kam there in the third person, but then kama, kamta, kamt, kamti, kamu, kamtem, kamtem, kamten, excuse me, and kamnu. So it's pretty much like what you've seen before. You just have to pay attention to what the vowel point is in that one syllable, beginning of kamas in the third person forms, and pathak and all the rest. So just a quick observation is about all you can do with that. Ba is a little bit different because you've got the quies nalef. Yes? Yes, well, there were apocopated forms that started looking like this. The term apocopated kind of has the idea of something chopped off. And I'm not sure if the term is used for these in their normal state or not. It's more in terms of things that were longer, but they got shortened down to things that look like this. So, right. Yeah, I remember some of your one yos and some of those later on, things that got chopped off, and we'll get to them a little bit later on, but those are the peculiarities. They end up looking like this, though. But the term apocopated usually has the idea that something was there and it was chopped off. Now, maybe something was on these before, too. As we'll see, these will be considered in the category of hollow verbs where there was thought to be something in between, a wow in both these cases, but perhaps and yos and some others. But this is more, hollow is in the middle. The apocopated usually means something was on front or back and got chopped off. That's kind of the idea there. Okay, the ba there, because aleph is the final root consonant, the same kind of thing happens there as with matzah. And so in this one, basically, if you look at the paradigm, you have a comma in the first syllable on all the forms. And we have the aleph quiescing. And no vowel point on the aleph in any of them except for the third person feminine singular where you have the comma se ending. And the rest of them all just have a quiescent aleph. And then the ending's tacked on. And, of course, the tau with no dagesh. Then here's another thing to watch on these. The stem of the participle of these verbs is the same as the third person masculine singular perfect. So for your participle, where we've been used to seeing an OA type formation, kolon seri, these verbs are so short you can hardly do anything like that with them. And so they just, the form stays the same. Kam here is the form for the participle as well as the form for the third person masculine singular perfect form. So sometimes it's possible to get confusion between those, and you have to make some decisions on the basis of context and so forth, which he deals with here just below, in deciding which is which. Now, of course, if you have it in the other forms, especially the plural forms, you won't have any trouble identifying those. Kamim can't be, it's got to be the plural form of the participle. It can't be one of the finite verb forms above, because none of them have endings like that, or kamos. As far as kama is concerned, there's a difference in stress. You've got kama, for she arose, as the verb form, and kama as the participle. So there's a difference in stress between those. And that's not always going to be marked real well in some of the texts. So, you know, he marks it in the book here. But it may not be marked in your text, so you may have to go by context there also. So he mentions that. And then, given a sentence such as ha'ish kam, we may, unless we have the context in which the sentence occurs, translate the man arose as a perfect or the man is arising participle. So either one. And so you're either getting a kind of a progressive aspect from the participle or more of an indefinite aspect from the perfect form. The only criterion that can be applied to an isolated sentence is that the perfect more frequently precedes the subject. Why would that be? Why do you think a perfect would more frequently precede the subject? Remember that? Yeah. Hey, Harry?
That's already on the book that does, but I'm thinking also of the series.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. If you're in a series, verbs usually, they stand first. And then, just as a general rule of thumb, what we saw earlier is that the normal word order in Hebrew is verb, then subject. And because of that, if kam is a verb form, if it's a finite verb form, it'll normally be in front of the noun. Not always. There will be exceptions. But, you know, he's just saying if you don't know, it could be either one, but if you've got to make a choice, the probability is that if the verb, if it's out in front, it's the finite verb form. If it's following, that's the normal position of participles anyway, because they're functioning like adjectives, and adjectives normally, you know, attributive adjectives anyway, follow the nouns, and so you would more likely pick it as the participle if it follows. So that's just a general rule of thumb. Of course, there are exceptions to that. All right, then section 65, the prepositions min and ke with pronominal suffixes. These are a little bit more difficult than you might expect just because they've got some additional syllables that you didn't expect. And so matter of just looking at the paradigm again, and mimeni, mimaka, mimek, similarities in the suffixes to what you've seen before. Mimenu again. One thing we have to watch for this is that mimenu from him is the same form as mimenu from us. So you have to tell from context which is which on that one. But other than that, it's just a matter of learning. Now, the preposition ke doesn't do like bu and le. Bu and le just put the little simple ending right on the bu and le. But this guy gets a name in there, in some of the forms at least. And so it's kamoni instead of just ki, like you might expect. It's kamoni. Of course, there is another word ki. Maybe that's part of the problem, that they got doubled up on words or something when they did that. And kamoka, kamok, etc. And then in the plural forms, you see kamonu, kahem, kahen, kahem, and kahen. Those are almost like what you would expect, but if it were regular. But the singular forms and the first person plural form have this main. So again, there's nothing much that can be done except to learn the paradigm. Okay. Then he talks about at the top of the next page, the forms like kamoni, for example, may be used as a quasi-pronominal in a quasi-pronominal sense, as anyone like me. Anyone like me. So just the word like me, if it's used like a noun, it'll gain the pronoun sense. And that's no different, really, than any other adjective or something being used as a noun. And it's not really surprising. Okay, then the little word coal. The word coal, in one form or another, corresponds variously to English each, every, all, or the whole. The uninflected form precedes the noun it modifies and may be joined with makef as coal. Now, again, why am I pronouncing it coal rather than kal here? Is there anything that helps? Huh? Yeah, there's no methag there, and it is a closed syllable with a comments in it. Yes. Yes, and it's also unaccented because, see, with the makef, that makes it not take the stress, and in effect, it makes it a closed syllable. In as far as the word is concerned, it's like a closed syllable in the beginning of a word, because that makef is kind of joining it accentually to the rest of the word, and so it fits the criterion of other situations where we would say kamas katuf. Okay, and of course the methag would have been there if it was going to be otherwise. All right. Then, in addition to the form of the word kol, it's somewhat dependent on how you actually translate it. Whether you translate it all or each or every or the whole depends on what kind of a noun it's associated with and whether the article's on it or not, so forth. So you look at these examples. You've got kol yom, each day or every day. Kol hayom, all the day or the whole day. See, there's a difference. When the article's on it, you've got all the day or the whole day. And when the article's not on it, it's each day or every day. And then kol hayamim, all the days, plural. Kol ir, each city or every city. But kol ha'ir, all the city or the whole city. And you can pretty much get it just by translating it literally. You know, put the in there, all the city, and that pretty well gives it to you in English, too. So it's a pretty good rule of thumb. So this doesn't really present a huge problem as long as you kind of just keep track of the presence or lack of the article. The expression kol asher is used as a compound relative. Everything which or everything that. As the subject of a verb is preceded by et, so here's an example. Nathan lo et kol asher kana. He gave him everything that he had acquired. So kol asher is kind of functioning as all that or everything that. And it's a pretty straightforward translation anyway. Then with an adjective, kol has an indefinite pronominal sense. Kol chadash, for example, anything new. And it still gets that pronominal sense to it, but it's a little bit, the whole thing kind of functions as a pronoun, but it's got this attribute of the adjective expressed there. Those are all pretty straightforward, too. If you run into those, you'd probably be able to translate it without any trouble, even having not seen it. If you just remember what kol means, and you just translate everything else pretty literally, it comes out fairly straight. Okay, questions on this chapter? The biggest problems may be just memorization, especially of those prepositions min and k. That's probably the biggest workload that you'll see in that chapter. Lesson 15, the perfect of savav. These are sometimes called geminate verbs because you've got twin letters, you know, Gemini meaning twin, apparently. I guess probably where they got it. Got two letters the same. The identical second and third root consonants is the feature to this. And what happens in these, as you might expect, maybe even at the outset, that sometimes these are going to get doubled. And that's basically your situation. In your third person forms, the two consonants remain separate. But in the first and the second person forms, they're doubled. And you just have one of the consonants with a dagesh. So that's the biggest and most obvious feature that's involved. Going beyond that, you've got savav, savava, that's okay so far, but then you get sabotha, saboth. You get a cholam wow there also, which makes it a long vowel, and then your tau softens, so you get that kind of a change happening. So it's best maybe to think of a different root. That's what he says. Here we find a new feature. Before all suffixes beginning with a consonant, the stem is sabo. So this, if you don't have a suffix beginning with a consonant, the stem is savav. So you have in savav with no suffix, savava, which has a vocalic suffix, and savavu, which has a vocalic suffix. They all stay the same, but then you get a different stem before the consonant suffixes. That's one way to think of it, too. Okay. See, otherwise the forms are relatively normal, but note chatef pathak for segol in accordance with section 11.2. So in the Savavu up there, for example, and Savava. They went ahead and put a Chatzes Pasach on that, and it's not a guttural. See, Beit is not a guttural, so it doesn't. It could take Shua. But what would happen if you had a Shua on those, just a plain Shua? Would there be any problem? How would you pronounce the word? Say Savavu there. Suppose you took that Chatzes Pasach off and just put a Shua on there. Yes. Yeah, it would look like it was closing the syllable, and you get a common skatuf there in pronunciation because it'd be short. So that's the reason they open it up. And then because, you know, I think it has to do too with the same consonant, you know, repeating too, that they often will make that vocalic. They want to make it vocalic, but they don't want to put a shwa on it to get some confusion. You know, they kind of get tied up with their system that they started. I think the Masoretes, you know, I mean, a lot of this stuff is kind of artificial. And so they went ahead and go ahead and put a chatzes pasach on it just to resolve that problem, keep the full comments in the first syllable. And
in section 11.2, says another device used in a word like the one just given to ensure correct reading is to point with a pasach and
stuff. Right. Okay.
So instead of using this one as a method, so instead of having a method there, they pointed it with.
Sure. That would have been another way to do it, is just put a method there. And but apparently they decided this is better, so that's what we've got. Okay. Was that the second bell? No, that was the first bell. The clocks are a little bit off. All right. A few other things here. When the last two root consonants are a guttural or resh, the forms where we would expect doubling are replaced with ones that show compensatory lengthening. So that's somewhat predictable, too. And instead of doubling, you can't put a dagation, a resh, or a guttural. And so you get a lengthening in the first syllable from the pasach to the comets. That's the only difference. So other than that, they're just the same. So arar, if you just look at arar all the way down the paradigm, it's the same as savav as far as its vowel points, except for the first syllable has the comets all the way through because the resh couldn't take dagesh, couldn't be doubled. All right. Prepositions im and f with pronominal suffixes. So here we see something that, remember F is kind of confusing because F is the object marker, but it also is a preposition meaning with. So when you see F by itself, there are some places where confusion is generated by that, and there are some debates in doctrine and you know, and interpretations because of that. But when you put the suffixes on, the ambiguity is resolved because the F that your object marker becomes like Othi and Othaka, etc. You get the holom on it. Whereas the F that's your preposition in the second paradigm here, Itti, Itaka, Itach, etc., you get a dagation in the tau and you get a hirik in the first syllable, so they come out with a different pattern. But the endings are basically the same. And then, of course, Immi and Imaka, Imach, and so forth. Both of those prepositions meaning with. And I couldn't tell you if there's a subtle shade of difference in meaning of that. Maybe Tony can work on that for the class or something, the project he's working on. See if there's any difference between im and f as far as the meaning with in Hebrew. I've never seen anything written on it to make a big issue out of it. Okay. And then he mentioned some of the unusual forms and so forth there. I won't take time to go through all the details. Final remarks on Asher. These are perhaps among the most interesting remarks on it, too. So this is worth taking a look at. Since Asher is not normally governed by a preposition in Hebrew, the counterparts of English to whom or for whom and the like must be expressed differently. You don't like to normally put a preposition on Asher. There are some situations where, you know, there are certain words that have come to be used quite a few times, quite frequently, but normally that's not the case. Well, we'll have to stop here and we'll pick up with these remarks next time. We covered, what, 4 or 5 chapters in 1 hour. It's pretty good. We sure didn't cover them that fast when we went through the first time. Won't be long, I'll be ready to chew on some new stuff. But it takes a certain amount of adjustment time. I think you're going to do a good job, so it's worthwhile. How are your textbooks holding up? You know, I know mine. I had to retape my binding and everything here with good old duct tape. It'll fix anything. Are they doing pretty good? I think that this new edition of them may be bound a little better.
I got a little crack in mine.
Uh-huh. In the binding? Yeah.
That's probably what happened. And what happened with mine is the backing here split. You know, it just kind of wore. And it began to split. So it came apart.